Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Simon Barrett, and this is another in my series, The Week in Reviews, a chance to sit down one-on-one with someone in the entertainment world. My guest today is Jeff Wolf, a man with a story. Jeff, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Simon. I appreciate that.
We have lots to talk about, but let's start with a really simple or difficult question, depending on how you view it. Why don't you tell our audience a little bit about yourself?
Well, I was born in Ohio and raised in Wisconsin, came to Southern California in 1965, and from there I was very fortunate enough to have grown up on transistor radio, or AM radio of the 60s, which was just fantastic, which influenced me to such a degree that in the mid-70s I really, really was compelled to perform music, and it such started getting furious going at that stage.
Oh, okay. I think you and I are approximately the same age. I grew up during that time, and my big plan was to start a rock band and become incredibly successful. Did you?
That's always the goal, but it's hard. It's a very laborious road to get to the successful part.
Right. I didn't even get past the learning to play an instrument part.
That's always helpful, but not always necessary, you know?
Right.
I think Mick Jagger learned to play an instrument after he'd been in the Stones for many years. So, I mean, you can always start from another angle.
Oh, you mean he does know how to play something?
Actually, Jagger is a fine, fine musician. On their last album, Bigger Bang, he played bass, piano, guitar, and percussion. And he's become a very, very fine rhythm guitar player, and he does indeed play bass on some of their studio tracks now. Which is pretty amazing.
Wow.
Yeah.
That blows me away. I thought all
Anybody
he did
didn't start
was
playing until he'd been in the band for a while. That's what's really amazing. He was just a singer and he started playing after the band had become successful.
Right.
Wild.
I just see him as strutting with his microphone.
he's great. He's still great, even at 71. I saw them last June, the Stones, and they were just incredible still.
I've talked to many musicians over the years, and I've listened to a huge amount of music. My head is just full of it. The late 70s were hell for musicians, or at least many of them. The punk phenom started in the UK, and musicians fled like, you know, rats deserting a sinking ship. I've talked to many of them. Al Stewart Al Stewart fame went on a 3-month tour of the U.S. and is still touring.
Never-ending tour.
Well, yeah. In his comment to me was, they hated Year of the Cat back home, so why the hell would I go back there?
You got to go where the audience is.
Right.
No audience, no show.
Right, yeah. And let's see, Emerson, Lake, and Palmer. They're a class act. According to Keith Emerson, they hated punk so much that they just went in tax exile. They couldn't care less.
Yeah. We received a lot of vitriol from a lot of musicians who were that came up before us in the Furies days, the early days of the Furies. But we also got some pretty solid support from surprisingly unusual sources. For example, Leon Russell in 77, 78 was a big fan of the Furies, oddly. And in fact, we took a meeting with him regarding signing to his label at that time, which eventually went bankrupt, so that deal never came through. But there were others. Jim Dixon, who produced The Birds, was a Furies fan during that era as well. Came to some shows, came to some rehearsals. So it's not everybody from that earlier era was down on new ideas. I mean, basically our thing was is we were tired of 7-minute songs. We wanted to hear a great 2.5-minute song and hear it on the radio and play gigs, and which just ended up what happened to it. So.
But you know, I've been listening to the Furies, old and new, and I'm still not sure that I would put you in the punk genre.
We got classified into that. They kind of dumped us into that ghetto, but we were never really punk per se. We were part of the punk movement in that we sort of rejected what was popular in that era and did something a little bit unique and different from the standard record label path that was coming out during that era. But we were more structured. We were more musician-driven. The songs had structure. There was arrangements, and there was melody and background vocals. And in a sense, there was a sense of grandeur some of those songs. Instead of just we would have arrangements and dynamics and things of that nature. We were one of the first bands out here to play ska, for example. We did in the very early days, we did a ska version of the Them song, Here Comes the Night, written by Burt Burns. And at that time, nobody was doing that kind of thing. We just loved Desmond Dekker, so we had covered the Israelites and put a ska tinge on some of our stuff. Nobody was doing that at that point, mid, 77, 78. So.
Yeah,
had other influences too. You know, we didn't deny that we loved the Stones and the Who like a lot of the punk bands, because a lot of those bands didn't have the capabilities to play that well, but fortunately we did have musicians in the band that could play really well, and so we were lucky enough to transcend the punk thing after a while.
Right. I'm still curious as to how you got labeled as punk, because everything I've heard smacks of unpunk.
In that early era, 76, 77, when we first started playing gigs, if you look at some of the flyers from that era, a lot of the bands, if there's four bands on the flyer, there'll be four different types of music. I mean, the Screamers were out at that time, and they were more of an early electronica duo, and the Zeros were pretty punk-driven, but they also did surf instrumentals, The Weirdos were definitely a punk band, but they were way early on into that era. You know, they kind of helped create that vibe out here in L.A., before anybody else was doing it. You know, there were a lot of bands really were more mainstream rock-driven. It was just that they were faster, louder, and they didn't use guitar solos. They didn't have 5-minute guitar solos. They just got in, did a 3-minute song, and they were out. So, a lot of bands like the Pop were more pop-driven, Beatles-esque, but it was all kind of lumped into the punk or new wave thing just because we weren't playing, grandiose arrangements or singer-songwriter type stuff, you know. We weren't Andrew Gold and we weren't Supertramp. We were the Furies, you know, so, or the Eagles for that, you know. So we didn't go in that direction, but it wasn't really as hostile as punk later became in the 80s.
Right. You mentioned Supertramp. A band I know quite well. Actually, I know their roadie. At the time, I went to school with him. Roger Hodgson's brother, I think. I think his name was Ian. And the last time I saw him, he had dropped out of college and was headed to somewhere to become their official roadie. Long time ago. Why don't we play a track from your new EP? How does Tear It Down sound?
Sounds great. That was a song I wrote in 1986 that we just got around to recording just a few months ago. So it's our latest recording that we've done in the series.
Well, songs are like fine wine. Yeah, they need to be laid down for a few years. So
I couldn't agree more.
Here it is. Tear It Down.
Thank you.
Confusion. My town is only my town. A wall is something between us, girl. Let's tear that wall down. Tear that wall down. Yeah. Once my sister, and she once was my bride. I can't describe how I missed her, but I left her behind. Well, it's a shame, a sin, and a crime, but I left her behind. Tear it down.
It wasn't until you told me that you wrote it in 88 that suddenly the light bulb went on. And you weren't possibly talking about the Berlin Wall, were you?
That was definitely in my mind when I wrote it. Indeed, it was true. Also, the just the whole, you know, the wall between men and women, the cultural social wall between men and women was also part of that whole song too, you know. But yeah, that was definitely an issue.
Right.
Tear that thing down. Whatever wall it is, you know. The last thing people need is wall between them. We need to shake hands and be friends.
Right, yeah. As I said, I hadn't spotted the fact until you told me, you know, the date that it was written, and then suddenly, you know, whoop, you know, I know what this is about.
Again, like you said, it's like fine wine, you know, a great song, and it can apply in any era relative to what's going on in contemporaneously, in the sense that a song that meant something that you liked from the 40s can mean something else in 2014, you know. So that's the beauty of any sort of art, if you want to qualify it as such, is that it can always be reinterpreted for another era and another generation. I mean, the Furies, you know, I was in a Americana band called the Horse Soldiers for 25 years after the Furies broke up, and my son came to me a couple of years ago and asked me about the Furies, and I hadn't really talked much about it to him because I was doing this other thing, you know, playing Johnny Cash songs and Waylon Jennings songs, and he said, "Dad, my friends and I really like this band, the Furies, and you were in that band." And yeah, and went ahead and made a CDR of a bunch of the songs, they taped some records, made a CDR and gave it to all his friends, and then all of a sudden, around the same time, I started getting airplay reports from BMI that they were playing Saved by the Black Sheep on Sirius Radio, on Little Steven's show. So this interest sort of started coming back around a couple years ago, and I was sort of hit with the idea of starting it up again.
Okay, I have to ask. I mean, Americana is very, very different from, I won't call it punk because I'm not sure it was. It was just an alternative style.
We always refer to ourselves as a rock and roll band. We never really, you know, addressed the punk issue so much. It was sort of other people would kind of lump us into that category, but we were just part of a movement at the time that wanted to make rock and roll a little bit more closer to its roots than it was at that time, you know. But and again, you know, there were so many bands from that era that were called punk bands that were really broader based than that, or at least not necessarily locked into that particular genre that everybody knows as it is now, you know.
Right.
But, you know, I had done that for a long time. I'd been in the series from 76 to 87, and I thought, you know, I can't keep doing this. I want to do something different. And I went back to the music I listened to when I was a really little kid in the late 50s, you know, Johnny Horton and Elvis and Ricky Nelson, and started wanting to sing cowboy songs, Gene Autry, you know, Roy Rogers, Tex Ritter. So I started doing that, and that went on to be 25 years of playing gigs and putting out records and, you know, going on TV and all that stuff too. So it was just totally different approach to music. And I took up acoustic guitar and started playing acoustic guitar on stage, which I'd never done in the Furies. And, you know, a lot of harmony. We had, and you know, a lot of, we had 120 songs in our set. We played airs and festivals and family events, things that the Furies would never been able to do. So it was a real eye-opening experience to go from, you know, nighttime gigs and smoke-filled drunken warehouses to sunny afternoons playing for, you know, families. A funny story, a real funny story. I was playing in the Horse Soldiers. I was playing a gig at the downtown Newhall Old West Festival out here north of L.A., and this band had opened for us, and a fellow from the band came up to me and said, hey, you know, I have your album, and I think you guys are great. I can't wait to hear you play and all this stuff. And I said, what's your name? And it was Tony from the Dills, who was then in a band called Cowboy Mouth. So I went, oh, well, Jeff and the Furies, man, wow, we're cowboys now. You know, it was wild. It was hilarious. The Furies and Dills played quite a few shows together back in the 70s. So it was kind of funny that they had gone that route, too. I know, it's wild.
I love that musicians, you know, are flexible. Yeah, I've met some that, you know, started out in the 60s, and, you know, that their music's great, but, you know, they're just firmly entrenched in it.
Exactly.
Yeah,
I know a lot of players that I knew that I've known for decades who are just, there's no growth musically. They're in that place, and it may be a good place, good for them. God bless them, whatever, bless their hearts. But ultimately, you know, you got to broaden your base. You can't just stay in one sort of little circle your whole life. Not only with music, but any of your other interests too. You know, you got to broaden your base, and so that's what I did. And, you know, ended up playing 400 dates in the Horse Soldiers and putting out 5 or 6 albums and some major level compilation albums with Cash and Willie Nelson and stuff. So, you know, we did good.
Okay. Let's do some absolutely shameless commercialization. Where can people buy copies of your new EP?
Well, it's available on all the standard download sites, iTunes and Amazon and all those. And if you just put in the Furies EP, or if you put in the Furies Tear It Down, or any of the other names of the songs, you go to the site to purchase it, and you can download it. We're talking to a couple labels now about putting it out also as either a 12-inch or 7-inch single, or maybe both. So once we get that deal established, we will have vinyl on it too. But at the moment, it's a easily downloadable work. It's 4 songs, the 2 new songs that we recorded, and then 2 classics, one from the 70s and one from the 80s. Say Goodbye to the Black Sheep, which was our big K-Rock hit. It has never been available for download before, from 1978. And then from 1986, from our EMI EP, we have The Girl Is Not at Home, which was always a live favorite. And, in fact, whenever we play this song live these days, too, people really respond to it. So it's 2 new songs, 2 new recordings, and 2 archival recordings.
Do you also have a website? Like, these days, no self-respecting musician doesn't have a Facebook account or a website or something like that.
Yeah, there's 3 Furies websites, 3 Furies Facebook pages. There's one that's all the stuff from the original lineup of the band, the Furies fan page, that's run by our guitar player, Chaz Maley, from the 70s lineup of the band. And then there's a page called the Furies 21st Century, which is all information related to the new activities of the band. And then there's a video and photo page that's also called the Furies on Facebook. So you can get your Furies overload if you go on Facebook.
Right. You can get furious.
Yeah, get Furious Radio on that, too. I got to say, it's a thrill that Little Steven has been playing Say Goodbye to the Black Sheep very consistently on his show on Sirius Radio. I get notices that it's been on all the time. It's almost like every couple of weeks I get another notice. Hey, I heard you on Little Steven's show, and it's just a thrill, you know, to be be on a show with a guy with such credibility as him, not only for his musical work, but also as Silvio in The Sopranos. So
okay,
I love that guy.
I think it's time that we played another track. Again, it's a new track, Wicked White. How do you think about that?
That would be great. That's a song I wrote in 1977 about how technology was starting to overwhelm the culture, and that here we are almost 40 years later, and what's changed? It's just gotten even more overwhelming.
It has indeed. Okay.
Yes, sir.
Let's take it out for a spin.
Great.
Had something to do with this song. Would you care to explain? I must be missing something.
Well, the song was written as kind of a reaction to the at that time it appeared to be overwhelming influx of technology upon the culture. You know, whether it was the early advent of computers or governmental overreach or things of this nature, and I'm kind of a walking in the woods kind of guy, and it gotten to the point for me where I was starting to feel sort of overwhelming, and as time has gone on, we're seeing more and more of that. I mean, I'm talking to you on a cell phone right now, and that wasn't even imaginable in 1977.
Right.
It amazes me as to how much things have changed, and yet in many ways they still, of course, stay the same. But, again, that song, even though it's, 35 years old, there's still a resonance there, and it's really, really fun to sing, which is ultimately the whole point of all of this stuff. If it wasn't fun to do it and it didn't thrill me as a singer, I wouldn't have bothered to instigate a revival of this music, But the fact that I went back and listened to these songs again, went, oh, geez, these were really fun songs to sing. I hadn't revisited them in 25 years until my son came to me and talked to me about it, and I went, oh, it'd be really fun to do again. And so that's kind of how it came about,
Oh, no, it's a great song, and now you've explained a little bit. Yes, I can see where Wicked White comes from.
It's like white noise. I mean, that was my thought, was white noise, Wicked White is the white noise that we hear in our heads when the TV goes off. In the old days when the TV used to go off, which it never does anymore, you'd wake up and you'd hear, and that sort of prompted me to write the song.
Yeah, I grew up in a time where that there were only three channels and everything ended at midnight.
Exactly. And I had a guy that I wrote all these songs with, Greg Embry, whose musical contributions to this always fueled the thing melodically and lyrically. So we were able to come up with dozens of really good songs that I feel, still hold up really well today. A lot of the new material that we do is just stuff that I've written on my own, but it's still in the same spirit of independence and do-it-yourself and fun that the original band had.
I think
I'm
you
thrilled.
Hit
I'm
the,
having a great time doing this thing.
Right. I think you hit it on the head on the nail. Right. Obviously, the Fury 1.0, the original band, probably is a little different to the Fury 2.0 that we have today. Who is playing with you?
Well, I've got Robert Lane, who was with me in the Horse Soldiers, who plays with me on bass in the Furies, and I've got a couple of guys that have played on the tracks that were with me in the 80s lineup. I've got a couple of other pools. I have a pool of musicians that I use for some of these shows. I've got a couple of the guys from Brian Wilson's band, a couple of drummers that I use. So it just depends on the venue and who, what, when, and where, because sometimes people's schedules don't cinch up. So not unlike a lot of country bands, I tend to use whatever musicians happen to be available for whatever shows I'm doing. If I was to go, say, out of the country, some of the guys that I play with aren't available to do that, so I would use some of the other guys that are available. So it just depends. I know Penelope from the Avengers runs her band that way, too. So it's really down to who and what, when and where, and who's available, and all that type of stuff.
Obviously, you love the stage over the studio.
Oh yeah. Everything else is just a path to get on stage and sing in front of people. You're rehearsing and recording and all that other stuff is just, to me, that's where the music comes alive, is when it's just a one-take thing. You're on stage, you do your show. That's it.
Yeah.
My whole thing is you get to the gig, you do your little dance, you sing your little song, you get your check, you say hi to everybody, and then you go home. To me, that's it. That's ultimate manifest. That's my mantra, Get on stage.
I don't know how many musicians I've talked to, and I've One of the questions I ask them, you know, is studio or stage? And, it's about a 50-50 choice.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the studio is safe. You know, if you make a flub, it's no
right.
big deal.
Right.
But, you know, you can do it again.
Mm-hmm.
On the stage, you get one shot. And
exactly.
if you nail it, fine. If you don't nail it, fine.
You live with a life of humiliation? To me, you know, I'm a danger man and I'm an action man. And to me, that's what the studio, what the stage is all about. It's action and it's danger. And I thrive on that, you know. And, you know, it's great to go in the studio and make it sound really good and all that stuff. You know, it's great. But to me, it's just laborious. And on those two songs you played, you know, those are first or second take vocals with little or no punches, because I just like to go in, sing the song, and then move on to the next thing we have to record. I don't really believe in, you know, beating a dead horse to make it sound, quote, perfect, because I don't think perfection exists anywhere, whether it's music or life or, you know, writing, whatever you want to look at. You know, there is no perfection. So you're not going to nail it. So just go in and do a great job in the first take and get the hell out of there and get to the stage, you know.
Right.
That's the way I look at it.
Yep. I'm going to sing this once and then I'm going to go have lunch.
Yeah, and no auto-tune either. You know, if you can't sing the song on pitch, if you can't go into any sort of situation and sing the song on pitch, then maybe you're in the wrong field. Maybe auto-tune is a very dangerous tool that's been instigated into the recording business. And, you know, and in live, there's a lot of acts that use auto-tune live, and that's why everybody sounds the same. Because they're all using auto-tune. Terrible.
I hate the concept.
Yeah, it's just ridiculous. If you can't sing a song on pitch, don't go on stage.
Right.
You know, Frank Sinatra didn't need auto-tune, and neither did, you know, whoever else you care to name.
Right.
You know, John Lennon. John Lennon didn't need auto-tune either. I heard somebody auto-tune. They took the Bob Dylan song, I forget what song it was, one of his great songs, and they auto-tuned it. It was just ridiculous.
Yeah.
Oh, Tangled Up in Blue. Somebody auto-tuned Tangled Up in Blue, the great Bob Dylan song. And it's like, what the hell? It just sounded awful, and it sounded like everybody else, yet again.
Yeah. The stage is live. It's here and now, warts
yep.
and all.
Yep, exactly.
Yeah, and
exactly.
Yeah, people love that. So,
yeah.
Where can people find you? Do you have any upcoming gigs planned?
We're going to be at the park in Burbank on the 26th of July at 9:00, and that's a Saturday, and then the following Friday we're going to be at Fe-Do-Do on Park Street in Los Angeles for the International Pop Overthrow Festival.
Huh. Is there a plan to release an album, you know, a full album, or
that would be our next goal recording wise. There is a plethora, yes, I said plethora, of material with the Furies, both old and new songs that were never recorded, and I am talking to a couple different labels. First of all, about getting the EP out, and then from there, getting a full album out. There's just plenty of material. Plus, I've got a lot of archival material. I've got a 30 live tracks from the 70s and 80s that are great that could be in a box set, for example. So there's a lot of material for the series.
Okay, I'm looking at the clock, and it's winding down. I want to thank you for taking part today
Well, thank you, Simon.
I know all I've done is annoy you.
And you're good at it, too.
Right?
You let me pontificate. That's wonderful.
It's my speciality. Do you have any parting thoughts for our audience?
I would just say, you know, music is the best way to communicate. It's the best way to love. It's the best for everything. And just keep it real and keep it live and keep it unencumbered by Pro Tools.
I really, really do want to thank you, Jeff. You know, I'm just a grumpy old man.
Well, so am I, but I put on a good face for your show.
I do wish you every success in the future, and please keep me in the loop. I would love to talk to you again.
I would love that too. It's been a pleasure.
Right.
Thanks so much, Simon.
Till next time, this is Simon Barrett wishing everyone a happy, healthy, and safe week. We'll be back again soon. Till next time, goodbye.